Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on War is a Racket when we come back. Well, how many laws did Moses give us in the Mosaic Law, and how many laws has our government given us in our secular government? And the answer is 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments for Moses. And at last count, 2.5 million laws that the state and our federal government and our local governments have given us over the past 200 years. 2.5 million laws. Now, the Apostle Peter said that we ought to obey God rather than men in Acts 5, verse 29. Congress said that we ought to voluntarily apply the teachings of the Scripture. That's right. Voluntarily apply the teachings of the Scripture in the lives of families, individuals, and societies. And our Supreme Court has said that there's a higher loyalty than loyalty to this country, and that is loyalty to God. And they said that in Seeger versus United States. Now, every authority is in agreement. The Congress, the Supreme Court, and God Almighty Himself are all in agreement that the Scriptures are the final authority on law. Now, to learn these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments and how to use them against government intrusion into your God-given rights is a right, a duty, and an obligation that we owe to ourselves, we owe it to our families, and we owe it to our society. And here at the law school, we teach these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, along with the penalties for the violation of these laws, and we do that twice a year, in the spring and the fall. So why don't you make it a point to regain your First Amendment right to free exercise this year? Remember, the First Amendment is the gateway to the Second, and indeed to your whole Bill of Rights. Now, the law of God may be old, but it's not old-fashioned, and it's very relevant to our lives, and it's very relevant to our rights today. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first? You know, that's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You're not out anything. Why don't you call right now? The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School is available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for your free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. O-R-G, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Hey, last time we were talking about this thing of Smedley Butler in his book, War is a Racket, Chapter 1, War is a Racket. We talked about the racket. It's a racket because it's an illegal activity, an illegal occupation that benefits the racketeers at the expense of society in general. And then, of course, the question number two, that is chapter two, comes up. Well, who is it that profits from these wars? And boy, there is just a wide variety of people that profit. And that's why war is so popular. I mean, you know, we talk about peace all the time. But, you know, peace doesn't make us any money. There's no profit in peace. And that's why there's so little peace and so much war, because there's so much profit in war and so little profit in peace that we have a lot of war and we don't have very much peace. I mean, that's just, as old Dan Rather used to say, follow the money. And we found out that, you know, outfits, you know, like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and these guys, you know, they wouldn't wish you any ill will or that you get killed when you go to Iraq. But, you know, when you go to war, kids, there's going to have to be some people get killed. We don't know who it's going to be. It's kind of like the lottery. We know that if you're driving your cars up and down the freeways, that today some people are going to get killed driving those cars. We just hope it's not you. We know that inevitably there are going to be some. And we feel kind of bad about the guys that die, but after all, you know, what's a few deaths in the pursuit of a broader goal? And the broader goal in Iraq is the stimulation of the American economy, which was on the rocks. It's on the rocks yet, and the war in Iraq isn't going to save it, but it's going to prolong it for a while. It's going to stretch it out for a few more years. I think it's a big price to pay, and I think there's a better way of dealing with economic strife. I think there's a better way to make profits than Warren. Smedley Butler thought so also. After 32 years in the military, I mean, here's a guy that knows where the bodies are buried. This is a guy that's actually been there. He walked the walk. He walked in that moccasin for 32 years. It just strikes me as being a pretty good authority on the subject matter of war. He said, hey, this war thing isn't all it's cracked up to be. That's his conclusion. Solomon married 1,000 women, had 1,000 wives, and he arrived at a conclusion. He said, I was better off with the wife of my youth. Just that one sweet girl, my 16-year-old childhood sweetheart, was probably the better plan for me rather than to have these 1,000 women. But, after he had done it and after he had experienced it, he reflected on his experience, and he said, when it's all said and done. Now, I'm not an activist for war, but I'm not a pacifist either. And there are times when you need to go to war. There have been some wars that needed to be fought. You look in the Bible and you'll find there's quite a few wars that were directed by God Almighty himself against certain groups of people. He said, hey, I want to go to war against this guy. I got a beef with him, and I'm going to straighten this out. I've got a quarrel, and I'm going to satisfy this quarrel. And he enlisted our guys to go in there and do that for him. Or with him. Or maybe in spite of him. I'm not quite sure. In some cases, it was a little bit of both. Or a little of all of the above. My granny used to say that the Bible is a bloody book. I think she's probably about half right there. There are a lot of wars and a lot of blood spilled in the scripture. And there are some laws that regulate and govern war. Of course, we don't follow any of those today. That's kind of passé. But there were a number of statutes that our God gave us, just like he gave us statutes concerning economics and agriculture and adultery. He gave us some statutes concerning war. And if we followed those statutes concerning war, we'd have a whole lot more peace, a whole lot less war. And when we went to war, it would be quick, sudden, violent, severe, and over. And then that would be the end of that. And that's the conclusion that our general has come to. He said, there's a time when we need to go to war, but, most of the time we don't need it. And it's counterproductive. And that's what he's been pointing out here. And he pointed to a guy that knows a little something about war also, a guy by the name of Napoleon. You've probably heard that name. Napoleon, he was a great emperor, great Frenchman, great general, conquered the world, or a lot of it. And Napoleon had this to say. He said, all men are enamored by decorations. They positively hunger for them. Did you get that? All men are enamored by decorations. And they positively hunger for these decorations. So by developing the Napoleonic system, Napoleon came up with this idea. Napoleon said, what we'll do is we'll strike some medals. So by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned that it could get soldiers for less money because the boys liked to be decorated. So until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out, and it made enlistments easier, and after the Civil War, no new medals were issued until the Spanish-American War. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With very few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, 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 to kill the Germans. God is on our side. It is his will that the Germans be killed. Well, now, on the other side of the Atlantic, in Germany, the good pastors over there called upon the Germans to kill, kill, kill the Allies. To please the very same God. And that was a part of the general propaganda on both sides. Build up to make people war conscious and then murder their conscience. Beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the war to end all wars. This was the war to make the world safe for democracy. No one told them that dollars and cents were the real reason. No one mentioned to any of them as they marched away to war that their going and their dying would mean huge war profits for the multinational corporations. No one told these American soldiers or the German soldiers or French or English soldiers that they might be shot down by bullets made by their own brothers here in America or England or France in the international armaments trade. No one told them that the ships on which they were going to cross might be torpedoed by submarines built with United States patents. They were just told that it was to be a glorious adventure, to make the world safe for democracy, to end all war, to bring the world peace. We need to go to war to bring the world peace. So, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to make them help pay for the war also. So we gave them the huge salary of $30 a month. This is World War I, boys and girls. $30 a month. All they had to do for this manifest sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in a swampy trench, eat canned willy when they could get it, and then kill, 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 and be killed. But wait, half of that wage, just a little more in a month than a riveter in a shipyard or a laborer in a munitions factory, safe at home, made in a day. So here's a guy working in a shipyard in America, making $60 a day, and here's this guy making $30 a month. Well, it was promptly taken from him to support his dependents, and so that they would not become a charge upon his community. Then we made him pay what amounted to accident insurance, something the employer pays for in an enlightened state, and that cost him $6 a month. He had less than $9 left. I made a mistake here, a little error here. It isn't $60 a day, $60 a month, $2 a day, working in the shipyards here in America, twice as much as the guy is making over there as a soldier in the Army. Now, the guy that's in the Army over in France fighting in the war has to take $15 a day, send it home. Then he's got to take $6 a month for his insurance. When he gets all three, he's got $9 a month left over. He's getting shot at. He's getting wounded. He's getting killed for $9 a month. Then, the most crowning insolent of all, or insult of all, he was virtually blackjacked into paying for his own ammunition, clothing, and food by being made to buy Liberty bonds at $100, and then we bought them back, and then when they came back from the war and they couldn't find work, they sold them for $84, and the soldiers bought about $2 billion worth of these bonds out of their $30 a month wages. Yes, sir, the boys, the soldiers, he's the guy that pays the greater part of the bill. His family pays it, too. The pay, and they pay it in the same heartbreak that he does. As he suffers, they suffer. At nights, as he lay in the trenches and watch shrapnel burst around him, they lay at home in their beds and toss sleeplessly, his father and mother, his wife and sisters, his brothers and sons and daughters, wondering if he was coming back from the war. Then when he returned home minus an eye or short a leg or with his mind broken, they suffered too, as much as and even sometimes more than he did. Yes, and they too contributed their dollars, their billions of dollars, to the profits that the munitions makers, the bankers, the shipbuilders, the manufacturers, and the speculators made. And they too bought Liberty bonds, and they too contributed to the profit of the bankers after the armistice and the hocus-pocus of manipulated Liberty bond prices. And even now, the families of the wounded men and of the mentally broken and those who never were able to readjust themselves are still suffering, and they're still paying. You think anything's going to be different when the boys come back from Iraq? Was it any different when the boys came back from Vietnam or Korea or World War II? When Butler says the war is a racket that's been going on for thousands of years, he's not whistling Dixie through a straw hat. And that's another reason why God gave us war statutes, laws governing war. And if we, the American people, or for that matter, the Germans or French or or the Chinese or anybody else, if they would follow those laws, we would have virtual peace worldwide and a whole lot less war. There might be a war from time to time. But they'd be a very rare event, and they'd be short and bloody and to the point. Then that would be it. And we could go back to doing what we do best. That is, living our lives and doing our thing. But you know, boys and girls, there are immense profits in pharmaceuticals. And boys and girls, as long as there's immense profits in pharmaceuticals, we're going to have drugs. And you can have all of the war on drugs that you want, but you'll never stamp them out because there's profit in it. And you can talk about peace, peace, when there is no peace, but you're never going to have peace as long as there's profit in war. Because of the profits in war, you have war, and because of the profits in drugs, you have drugs. It's just that simple. The profits in booze give us whiskey. The profits in tobacco give us Marlboros. The profits in war give us Iraq. That's the way life is. It's always been that way, and it's always going to be that way. Nothing's going to change. Now, you don't have to participate in that. I'm not suggesting that you opt out or cop out if that's your choice. My observation is the same as Smedley Butler. If you boys want to go over there and fight for medals, get after it. Just leave me out. I'm not interested in sharing my wealth, my time, my effort and energy with Bechtel, Halliburton, or Kellogg Brown and Root. They're going to have to fend as best they can when they can without my help. Now, our friend Smedley here has a chapter, chapter 4, How to Smash This Racket. His observation is, hey, I think we need to smash this racket. Chapter 3, pays the bills. Chapter 2 dealt with who makes the profits. Chapter 1 deals with war as a racket. And now he comes to the point and he says, let me tell you how I would go about smashing this racket. Let's do away with it. It's a wild new idea. Well, it's a racket, all right, he says. A few profit and the many pay. But there is a way to stop it, and you can't end it by disarmament conferences. You cannot eliminate war. You can't eliminate war by peace parleys in Geneva either. Well-meaning but very impractical groups cannot wipe out war by resolutions. War can be smashed effectively only by taking the profit out of war. I'm going to underline that. This guy's got his head on straight, in my view. It can, that is, war can only be smashed effectively by taking the profit out of it. You got to take the profit out of drugs, kids. You got to take the glory out of war and the profit out of it. Once the profit's gone, I mean, you know, let's take a look at this thing of abortion. I remember I had a student in here one time. He's one of these radical anti-abortion guys. And he was lamenting, and he brought me literature, and it's really gut-wrenching literature. I mean, they've got pictures of fetuses, you know, and these fetuses are dead or dying, and they've got the partial birth abortions, and I mean, it's pretty bloody, it's pretty gory stuff. And I said to the man, I said, well, you're not going to do anything about abortion until you take the profit out of it. Now, America is just about evenly divided on this abortion thing. About half the people are in favor of it, and about half the people are opposed to it. Now, the people that are opposed to it, they're just running around like chickens with their heads cut off, just frantically trying to save all of these lives, all of these infant babies' lives over here, that the people who are having these abortions want to kill. They don't want to save their lives, they want to destroy them. And the people who, the people who are opposed to abortion, they're not the people who are having these babies or feeding these babies or caring for these babies. And my wife and I were kind of discussing the issue one day, and my wife, very, very astute lady she is, and she said, you know, these people that want to save all these babies, there's not a one of them that would get out of bed and go down and adopt one. Did you hear that? You know, all of you anti-abortion people, how many of you actually go down and adopt one of these babies? You mean you're opposed to abortion, but you're not very pro, let me take one home and raise it. Now, we're old folks here, and we raised in our families, and between the two of us, we raised 12 children. We weren't opposed to babies and children, and we had children of our own that weren't too competent or reliable, and they had babies, and we raised theirs too. And we took care of the Gordon family. We took care of the children that needed to be cared for. We didn't board them out, and we didn't send them off to a foster home or orphanage. We took care of them here. And if we did the same thing nationwide, you know, if families took care of families, why, we wouldn't have this abortion problem. But we don't do that anymore. We quit doing that a long time ago. And as a result of that, you have a cause and effect. And the same thing translates into war, or translates into economies, translates into drugs and so on. There's profit in it. There's profit in foster homes. There's profit in this child care, the state child welfare program. Great profits. That's why you have so much of it. That's why they're taking about 2.5 million children a year out of American families' homes and placing them in foster homes. There's money in it. Drugs, there's money in it. War, there's money in it. Anytime there's money in it, there's more activity. If you want to generate more activity, just put more money in it. And the reason this war in Vietnam is so popular, I mean, it is popular. It is a wonderful war. It's making gigantic profits, probably greater profits than any war in history. And it's being mined by the profiteers in a way that they have never mined wars in the past. Every war gets better and better. Like the profits in drugs, it gets better and better. It's like the social ladies. They're getting better and better at taking children out of their homes and placing them in other homes. Every white baby in America under the age of 1 year is worth $80,000. $80,000. So you take some girl that's on drugs, gets pregnant, that's a star prize, you know, for social lady. And the abortion business, it's a big business in America because there's big profits in it. Take the profit out of it and see how many abortion doctors want to go out and practice abortion just to be nice guys. It's like organ donor transplants. You got little Timmy over here, you know, he needs an organ transplant, and he needs $250,000. And Marge and Tom, they put little boxes out, you know, you see them in the 7-Eleven stores, you know, please donate to little Timmy's transplant operation over here. Well, who's going to get that $250,000? Well, hospitals, they're not in business, you know, to help little Timmy. They'll sit there and watch little Timmy die before they give him that organ transplant. And the doctors that get paid out of that $250,000, they'll sit there and watch little Timmy die before they give little Timmy that transplant. So it's up to you and me and all the rest of us out here to pony up the money for the profiteers in the hospitals and the doctors and the clinics and the organ companies, you know, that secure these organs and the morticians and the rest of them that all take a part out of that pot. And so here's old Smedley says, okay, now if you want to do away with war, you take the profit out of it. Now, wild new concept, but I agree with him. I think that's exactly correct. The only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital and industry and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. 1 month before the government can conscript one young man of the nation for war, it must conscript capital and industry and labor. Let the officers and the directors, let the high-powered executives of our armament factories at Boeing and Lockheed Martin and our steel companies at United States Steel and their munitions makers, you know, the DuPonts and the shipbuilders like Todd Shipyards and our airplane builders like Boeing and Lockheed and the manufacturers of all the other things that provide profit in wartime, as well as the bankers and the speculators, let them all be conscripted first to get $30 a month, the same wage as the lads who are going to fight the war in the trenches. Did you get that? Here's a three-star general. He says, you want to do away with war? Let me show you how to do that. First thing you do is you go over to Boeing and you take their board of directors and you say, we're going to war in Iran and we're going to need airplanes. We're going to need a lot of stuff. And the first thing we're going to do is to draft all of you top white-collar executives of the Boeing Aircraft Company, and we're going to pay you the same grunt wages for the duration of the war that the soldiers are going to get when they go out to fight it. Boys and girls, that's going to be as popular as AIDS at an office Christmas party at the Boeing Company. Then you walk in and you tell all the people in all the defense industries at Halliburton and Bechtel, you know, all of you guys are going to get paid just exactly the same amount of money every month, month in and month out, as the boys that are over there in Iraq fighting today, getting shot and killed. Those boys over there are getting about $300-$500 a month, something like that. That's what you boys are going to get paid here while you're turning out the munitions for this war. Boys and girls, that's why the war, I predict, would be short, bloody, and to the point, so that we can get back to real business. If everybody had to sacrifice, we wouldn't be nearly as interested in war, or nearly as passive about it. You know, you just picture this. I don't know what those boys are getting over there in Iraq, but I don't think that there's very many of them getting $500 a month. And I know that if I was reduced to $500 a month for duration of the war, we wouldn't be at war for 3 or 4 years. And every time I hear the president say we're going to be in this for a long time, the next election would be about the length of my attention span. Be about the length of everybody's attention span. Working for those kind of wages. Now, again, you know, the guys that are over there all volunteered to go over there, and we all supported the war, and we all got behind George Bush, and we said, let's go get them suckers. Remember? So we're all in this together. Then Butler goes on to say, he says, let all these kings and tycoons and masters of business and all those workers in industry, you know, all you guys that are out here working on the assembly lines at Halliburton, and Kellogg, Brown, and Root, and Bechtel, and all you guys that are working up there, and Boeing, you know, and Seattle, and all around, and Lockheed Martin, all of you guys get paid the same amount of money, $30 a month. That's what they were getting back in the 1930s. Today, it would be more like about $500, maybe $600, something like that. You know, let you guys, you know, start sacrificing like the soldiers. And then let's see how long this war is going to last and how popular war is going to be. He says, let all these kings and tycoons and masters of business and all these workers in industry and all our senators and governors and all the mayors, let them pay half of their monthly $30 a month wage to their families and pay war risk insurance and buy liberty bonds. And after all, why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they do their fair share? They're not getting shot at. They're not sleeping in dirty trenches. They're not being wounded. They aren't running any risk of being killed or having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. They aren't sleeping in muddy trenches. They aren't hungry. It's the soldiers that are doing all of that. You give capital and industry and labor 30 days to think it over, and you're going to find that at the end of 30 days there will be no war, and that will smash the war racket, and there isn't anything else that's going to do it. Now, what do you think the chances of getting a bill like that passed through Congress or getting your president to sign it? What makes you think that the lobbyists, you know, on K Street aren't going to be working all of their rounds and all of their offices trying to trounce any such legislation as that? I mean, let's face it, kids, that isn't going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, then you're going to have more wars. So don't sit here, you know, and complain about war. We were all in favor of the war. I remember there was a lady that was protesting out in George Bush's ranch here a couple of years ago. Her name was Cindy something or other. McMahon or Cindy Lehan or something like that. And she just really bitter. Look, if her kid hadn't been killed and somebody else's kid had been killed, she wouldn't have been out there protesting. People whose kids aren't killed in the war don't get excited. They don't care about that one way or the other. It's after your kid gets killed. It's after your kid gets blown up and he's turned into a vegetable or he's lost his legs or something like that. Now that'll get your attention. And where were you parents when your kid came to you and says, Dad, I want to go join the Marines? Where was your sage advice, Dad? Well, when did you say to your kid, wait a minute, son, think this over. War is a racket. You know, this thing is a racket for the making of profit and gain for the executives at Lockheed Martin and Halliburton and Bechtel and Boeing. This isn't anything that you want to get involved in. Any of you fathers out there doing that? I'm watching the news every night. A kid gets killed, and his dad is real proud of him, and he says, well, I was a Marine, and my boy was a Marine and got killed in Iraq, and my dad was a Marine, and his dad was a Marine, and we come from a long line of military people. You know, you can go back in the Bible, and you can look at King David. He was a military man, and his brothers were military men in the service. His sons were military men in the army. He came from a long and proud line of military men. And if you want to know what God thought of it, he said, you know, David, you're a bloody man, and I don't want you building any temples for me. I'll have your boy Solomon do it, but not you. I'm not sure that God was all that enamored with war. In fact, the creator God, I mean, the God of the Bible, this is a new guy, probably you hadn't heard this before, but he said, I'm never very happy with the death of the wicked. I'm not sitting here gloating over the death of the wicked. That lends me a little credibility when I say I don't think God's all that excited about war. I'm not talking about every God. I mean, there's lots of gods out there, but I mean, this particular God, he's not enamored by war. Didn't think too much of it. That's why he gave us some laws concerning war, and he said, hey, listen, this war thing's over here kind of bad, and I want you to follow my statutes when we get down to this thing of war. Hang on a second. Let me give you a reminder here, and we'll continue on with Smedley Butler's Here's How to End War when we come back. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint isn't necessarily endorsed in total by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, though, are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, or the sponsors, or the management or staff of this network, or of this local radio station. They're just selling time. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us at 417-273-4967. Now, we're selling a book here called War is a Racket. I think it'll open your eyeballs from the perspective of a 3-star general, a Marine general. I mean, this guy's a trained professional killer. Trained professional killer. And he was out here killing people. He says, a little later in the book, I'll read it to you when we get to it, but he says, I was out here working hard, killing people for Brown Brothers, Harriman, Rockefellers, J.P. Morgan, United Fruit Company. I mean, he just names a number of big multinational corporations and banks and trusts. He was out here, he says, he's just a mafia hitman. Just out here doing his job, getting paid his money. You can get a copy of the book. It's called War is a Racket, and the author is Smedley, S-M-E-D-L-E-Y, S-M-E-D-L-E-Y, Smedley D. Butler, B-U-T-L-E-R, and War is a Racket is the name of the book, and you can get a copy probably from Barnes & Noble, $10 or something like that. War is a Racket, copyright 1935 by the Butler family. Smedley Butler's contribution to common sense neutrality. Copyright 1939. You know, prior to World War II, we were interested in neutrality in the United States. We had this neutrality doctrine here, and of course that was overcome by FDR and the Warhawks. And of course, Pearl Harbor came into play. But Pearl Harbor was instigated by the Roosevelt administration. See, they put an embargo on oil shipments to Japan in 1937. That'd be about like Russia putting an embargo on oil shipments to Western Europe, or putting an embargo on oil shipments to the United States, or Venezuela putting an embargo on oil shipments. Do you know what'll happen? Let me make a little prediction here. Have you got any idea what would happen if that 14% of the oil supply that we Americans get from Venezuela were cut off in the morning? Do you know what would happen to the people in Venezuela? Do you know what would happen to that guy Chavez down there in Venezuela if he shut off the oil coming to the United States? There would be instantaneous regime change in Venezuela. And I mean in days, not weeks or months or years like it took the Japanese. I mean in days. You can rest assured that the Venezuelans are going to continue to sell oil to the United States without any interruption. There might be a lot of grousing and there might be a lot of rhetoric, but there's not going to be any diminishing of the oil shipments. Now that's the bottom line. And everybody in the world understands that. Well, maybe not quite everybody, but everybody in the know is surely aware of that. Now, Smedley Butler, in his contribution here, if you want to get a copy of the book, Ferrell House is the publisher, F-E-R-A-L-H-O-U-S-E, P.O. Box 39910, that's 39910. Los Angeles, California, 90039. I guess you could write to them for a copy of it. They've also got a webpage, www.ferrellhouse.com, all one word, Ferrell House, F-E-R-A-L-H-O-U-S-E.com. And they got a webpage, an internet connection, you know, a letter writing service. What do you call that? Email. It's info@ferrellhouse.com. All right, we're talking about how to end war. And this guy's got his finger right on the pulse of reality here when he says what you do is take profit out of it. Maybe I'm a little too optimistic. He says capital still has some say, so capital won't permit the taking of the profit out of war until the people, those who do the suffering and still pay the price, make up their minds that those they elect to office shall do their bidding and not that of the profiteers. Now, right now in America, when a lobbyist from Boeing goes into a senator or representative, he goes in there with his purse. I mean, this guy's got money. We call them campaign contributions. In the Bible, they're called bribes. They're called gifts in the Bible, but they're bribes. And that senator or representative is going to vote the way the pharmaceutical industry or the auto industry or the armaments or the aircraft industry wants him to vote. Their votes are for sale. Those politicians are for sale. They're just a bunch of whores out on the street doing tricks. Their tricks are done for lobbyists and done for corporate America. But they're for sale. And y'all know that. There isn't anything I'm telling you here that you don't know. And that's why you've got war in Iraq, and that's why you got war in Afghanistan, that's why you're going to have war in Iran, and you're going to have war in North Korea. You're going to have more of it, not less, more of it. And especially as the economy weakens. You see, the weakening of the economy creates a lot of hate and discontent at home, and you got to keep people's minds occupied. You know, you got to keep these people off the streets and out of the pool halls. So war is the way they do that. And the way to make soldiers or to make boys happy is to give them medals. And so they draft us into the army, give us medals, send us over here to make the world safe for, corporate America. Another step necessary in this fight to smash the war racket is a limited plebiscite to determine whether war should be declared. A plebiscite not of all the voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and the dying. There wouldn't be very much sense in having the 76-year-old president of a munitions factory, or the flat-footed head of an international banking firm, or the cross-eyed manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting for or against war, now would it? Voting on whether the nation should go to war or not by these misfits? They never would be called upon to shoulder arms, to sleep in a trench, or to be shot, Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for their country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. God, that's a wild new concept. Let's think about that for a minute. We're in this war in Iraq. And the other day, the American people were called upon to vote for whether or not we should continue, that is, for you guys over there doing the fighting, whether we should let you continue. Wouldn't it be a wild new concept to have a vote among the 160,000 soldiers? Hey, how many of you guys want to continue the fight? How many of you want to cut and run? How many of you want to phase out slowly? Let's take a vote. You're the guys getting shot at. You're the guys getting killed. Why would you want to ask me? You know, as Smedley Butler says, you know, George Gordon, a cross-eyed profiteer or a flat-footed banker. Why don't you go ask the guys that are getting killed? You got to admit, kids, that's a wild new concept. Of course, we wouldn't do that. I mean, we're not insane. We're not going to do anything like that. But then if you don't, then you're going to continue to have wars. Now, the guys that are over there getting shot at every day, I mean, they can take a look at the war and whether or not they think it's worth it and whether or not we're going to achieve any meaningful goals over there and whether or not this thing is going right or, you know. I remember one time Donald Rumsfeld was over there talking to the boys, and one of the boys stood up and he says, "Hey, Don, how come we got to rifle around through garbage dumps to get some steel to put armor in our Humvees over here? How come we can't get some armor?" And Donald Rumsfeld, he thought about it for a second. He shot back and he said, "You go to war with what you got. And what we've got is Humvees without armor." Now, it would seem like to me that instead of making the soldiers go out to garbage dumps to dig out their own armor, couldn't we send a shipload of armor over there and put it out there and say, "Okay, boys, why don't you, here's the stuff you need. Now go put it in your Humvee." I mean, if we couldn't ship them the Humvees with the armor already in it, how come we couldn't just send them a little steel and maybe a couple of welders and maybe a couple of cutting torches and say, "Hey, fix your own"? No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to give them anything. And then we're going to get in their way if they try to fix this thing themselves to save themselves. Didn't seem like a very, very good thing to me. Well, this guy Butler goes on, he says a little more. He says, "There is ample precedent for restricting the voting to those affected. Many of our states have restrictions on those permitted to vote. In most states, it's necessary to be able to read and write before you can vote. In some states, you must own property. It would be a simple matter every year for the men coming of military age to register in their communities, as they did in the draft during World War I, and to be examined physically. Those who could pass and who would therefore be called upon to bear arms in the event of war would be eligible to vote in a limited plebiscite. They should be the ones to have the power to decide. Not Congress, not a few of those members who were within the age limit and the fewest still of whom are in physical condition to bear arms. Only those who must suffer should have the right to vote." Boy, that's pretty powerful medicine, kids. Now, these kids, they might all say, "Let's go get them," you know, like they did in World War II. You know, "Hey, let's go get them jabs." Okay, well, then you don't have anybody to blame but yourself when you get over there and you're getting shot at and you're getting killed. That's why in this war, these soldiers have a whole lot less to complain about than they did in prior wars. These guys haven't been drafted. They all volunteered. Now, I'm kind of an old man. I'm sitting over here in the peace, comfort, and safety of America and so on. And I'm being told by my politicians over here that these brave Americans are over there fighting and dying to make the world safe for democracy. And I want to tell all of you people that are fighting and dying to make the world safe for George Gordon, knock it off. Don't do it for me. Leave me out of the loop. I don't want you boys over there fighting, dying, and getting shot at on my behalf because I don't need it. Now, we used to have a God over here in Israel. over here in America. I mean, we used to have a real God that fought our battles for us. We had a real God that made our enemies to be at peace with us. We had a real God over here that when we obeyed him and kept his commandments, he fulfilled his half of the bargain and gave us our 33 benefits. This war over here is a curse. That isn't a blessing. That's a curse. And we've been cursed by our own God, and we're being reproved by our own doings. There's a prophecy in Scripture that says you'll be reproved by your own doings. It's kind of like the guy that's out here tearing off a little off of the country girl on Friday night, and she gets knocked up, you know. And then one day, well, he gets reproved by his own doings. You know, the little head's ruling over the big head. Can't think for himself anymore, and so one day finds out that everybody's in trouble. So, big problems here. A third step in this business of smashing the war racket, so says Smedley, is to make certain that our military forces are truly forces for defense only. Defense only. No offense. Just defense. Now, at each session of Congress, the question of further naval appropriations comes up. So, the swivel chair admirals of Washington, and there are always a lot of them, are very adroit lobbyists, and they're very smart men. They don't shout that we need a lot of battleships to war on this nation or that nation. Oh, no, no, no. They don't do it that way. First of all, they let it be known that America is menaced by a great naval power. Almost any day, these admirals will tell you, the great fleet of this supposed enemy will strike suddenly and annihilate our 125 million American people, just like that. Then they begin to cry for a larger navy. For what? To fight the enemy. Oh, no, 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 no. No, no. They're not here to fight the enemy. They say it's for defensive purposes only. And then, incidentally, they announce maneuvers in the Pacific for defense. Uh-huh. You get that? Now we're going to have maneuvers in the Pacific. Now the Pacific is a great big ocean. And we have a tremendous coastline on the Pacific coast of the United States. So will these maneuvers be off the coast of California, Washington, or Oregon, 200 or 300 miles? Oh, no, no, no. No, these maneuvers will be 2,000 miles away, perhaps 3,500 miles away, off the coast. Off of whose coast? Well, the Japanese coast would be a good place for America to hold naval maneuvers, don't you think? Now, the Japanese are a proud people, of course. And they should be well pleased beyond expression to see that the United States fleet is holding naval exercises so close to the Japanese coastline. Even as pleased as would be the residents of California or Washington or Oregon, were they to dimly discern through the morning mist the Japanese fleet playing war games off Los Angeles, San Francisco, or Seattle. There's a neat book out, which is called America, the Road State. I'm going to get a copy of it and share it with you. You know, we Americans have a perverted view of the world. For some reason, it seems to be okay for the American fleet to be holding fleet exercises between Formosa and China. Makes all the sense in the world to us. And then we get real surprised when the Chinese over there take offense. But Butler put the shoe on the other foot and he said, well, excuse me, but let's suppose that the Russian Navy were holding fleet exercises 200 miles off the coast of Los Angeles. What would you Americans think of that? Seems to be okay when America does that off the Russian coast, but it doesn't seem to be nearly as funny or fun if they did it over here off our coast. I just thought I'd throw that out because Mr. Smedley Butler threw it out first clear back in 1935. And he says, you know, it's one thing if you're dealing with defense, it's something else if you're dealing with offense. His consensus, or his opinion, it isn't consensus, his opinion, lacking a consensus, is that everything that we do here in a military way is done for the defense of the United States. And that we don't have offensive weapons. Don't need them. Well, you don't need offensive weapons unless you're going to attack somebody. Now, our president has changed America's role in the world. See, we used to talk about defense, and now we're talking about preemption. See, we're not talking about defending against the Iranians. We're talking about the Iranians are doing something that we don't want them to do. See, we don't want them to go nuclear. We don't want them to build nuclear weapons. It seems to be all right for the Pakistanis to build nuclear weapons. I don't understand why we don't go to war against Pakistan and disarm them. I don't understand why we don't attack India and disarm those crazy lunatics over there with the turbans on their heads and take those nukes away from them. I think we need regime change in Pakistan and India because they've got nukes. Don't you? Well, then why is it all right for Pakistan and India to have nukes and the Iranians and the Iraqis and the Saudis or the South Africans or Brazilians can't? Or the North Koreans or the South Koreans or the Japanese? Now, I would be the first to say it would be a better world if we didn't have nukes. That genie, when it got out of the jar, wasn't good for anybody. And any thought that we're going to have that we're going to stuff that genie back in the jar is just, Alice in Wonderland, Lilliputia crap. That isn't going to happen. That isn't going to happen. But now we got to get down to, do you really think that we need to go to war against Iran and kill 1 million or 2 million Iranians and then kill 100,000 American troops and blow everybody up and destroy the country and the infrastructure? And cut off the oil supplies and run the price of oil up to $100 or $200 a barrel and spend another trillion or $2 trillion or $5 trillion and go into debt for the next 300 years so that the banks like J.P. Morgan and Citicorp and Boeing and Lockheed Martin can make more profit? Don't they have enough already? How much money does Lockheed and Boeing need anyway? How much money does Bank of America or J.P. Morgan need to bring peace in the world? Is there a number that we could place on that so that we could pay the suckers off and get back to doing something more intelligent? No, I don't have any sympathy for the North Koreans. They're probably a bunch of jerks. And I don't have any sympathy for the mullahs in Iran either. They're probably a bigger bunch of jerks. But my point is why do we want to get involved in the lives and in the business of a bunch of jerks around the world? Why do we want Americans to be killed, and why do we want to spend ourselves into bankruptcy fighting a bunch of jerks around the world? Why is that necessary? Picture this. I mean, if you're just looking for a fight, I mean, you just can't contain yourself anymore. Why don't you just go down into the Watts neighborhood, find a black guy, call him the N-word, and get it on? I mean, if you're just looking for a bitch with somebody, well, go find one. I don't think you'll have to look very far. Now, most of us, you know, we don't run around looking for fights. We're not running around picking on people, most of us. Why is it that we're running around trying to pick a fight with the Iranians? Why are we trying to pick a fight with the North Koreans? Put another way, what if the North Koreans had 3,000 nuclear weapons, all armed and triggered, and aimed at the United States? So what? The Chinese and the Russians already have 9,000 nuclear weapons, all aimed, poised, and trained on the United States. What the hell's another 3,000? Seems like to me 10 or 15 be enough. I'll guarantee you this, about the first or second nuke that goes off here in the United States, we'll think that's plenty. So here again, Butler is putting a pretty plain offer on the table. He's sitting there saying, why do we need to get involved in all these complaints around the world? You know, like Sudan and Darfur, or Rwanda, or Uganda, or China, or Formosa, or Korea, or Iran, you know. Isn't there enough trouble in the world without us meddling? That we got to go stir up some more hate and discontent to make some more airplanes so that we can make some more profits for Lockheed Martin? I don't know, kids. Evidently, they don't have enough money and they need more war to make more planes to make more profits. It's always been that way. Let's see. Now, the ships of our Navy, it can be seen, should be specifically limited by law to within 200 miles of our coastline. Had that been the law in 1898, the Maine would never have gone to Havana Harbor in the first place. So, therefore, it never would have been blown up. And, therefore, if it blew up, it would have blown up someplace else, and we wouldn't have blamed the Spaniards for it. The ship never would have been blown up. There would have been no war with Spain, with its attendant loss of life. 200 miles is ample, in the opinion of most experts, for defensive purposes. Our nation cannot start an offensive war if its ships can't go any further than 200 miles from our coastline. Planes might be permitted to go as far as 500 miles from the coast for purposes of reconnaissance, and the Army should never leave the territorial limits of the United States of America. To summarize, these steps must be taken to smash the war racket. We must take the profit out of war. We must permit the youth of the land who would bear arms to decide whether or not there should be a war, and we must limit our military forces to home defense purposes only. I know this is a wild new concept, totally unacceptable to most Americans. But then, okay, then peace is totally unacceptable to most Americans, so let's just face reality. So quit bitching when you get into the next war. When you've got a war raging with Iran and North Korea, don't sit here and complain about it. Boys and girls, we have about 2.5 million men under arms, and those people that are under arms are located in 126 countries around the world. We have troops in Japan. We have troops in England and France and Germany. We have troops in 126 countries around the world. Those people are all trained killers. Those people are there as occupying forces. Let's just be realistic. The United States of America is an imperial world superpower, and we want to stay that way. And the price that we pay for empire is huge. You know, you gotta pay for empire. And we're paying the price for empire. What we want is empire without any costs. Now that isn't gonna happen. We want empire without any wars. That isn't gonna happen. Now Americans will say, well, we're not an imperial power and we're not an empire. What in the hell do you call 100 troops in 126 countries? There isn't anybody else in the world that's got troops in 126 countries, kids. So why do we have them there? Well, it's to maintain peace and stability in the world. For what purpose? They're not having any war in China. We don't have any troops over in China. They're not having any war in Brazil. We don't have any troops in Brazil. They're not having any war in Russia, and we don't have any troops in Russia. In the places around the world where there are no American troops, there's no war. Where there are American troops, there are wars. In Colombia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the threat of war everywhere in the world where American troops are located. Name one where there isn't the threat of war. Korea? Okay, kids, we're about out of time again. Chapter 5 says, to hell with war. That's Smedley Butler. To hell with war, coming up next time on the Law Hour, an editorial review. So let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law Hour and The Law School, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Hey, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.